You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson in for Rob Ferret. Coming up November 3rd is going to be a challenge for people organizing and working the polls. We'll talk with a Wisconsin data researcher about her recommendations for making Election Day as efficient as possible. Now, October is National Bullying Prevention Awareness Month. And as the pandemic shifts learning online, it feels like an even more pressing issue, as it can be harder for teachers and peers to flag cyberbullying when they aren't physically near students. And when cyberbullying goes unaddressed, the effects on kids can look very similar to depression and anxiety. Justin Patchen is a professor of criminal justice in the Department of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. He's also the co-director of the Cyberbullying Research Center. Justin, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Judith. Happy to be with you.
So are we able to measure whether virtual learning has impacted the prevalence of cyberbullying?
Not precisely. I think there's evidence basically to support that it could be increasing or could be decreasing. It really depends a lot on the child and the situation and sometimes the schools. One thing we know is that obviously more and more kids are online. They're connected now more than they ever were. But we also know that cyberbullying often accompanies traditional kind of face-to-face bullying. And so we know that that face-to-face bullying has decreased a lot over the last 6 months. So it stands to reason that cyberbullying could have decreased as well. Although, again, with more kids online, you might expect more cyberbullying behaviors to happen as well. So that's a long way of saying it might be, but we don't know for sure.
Well, and also, even though schooling is online, I'm guessing that it's not necessarily in a strictly classroom environment, whether it's virtual or in person, that the bullying is happening. It's probably in other parts of being online.
That's right. And I think what we've seen is younger kids getting access to more technology at an earlier age because of the current learning situation. And so you'll see second, third, fourth graders getting a Chromebook and not necessarily being given adequate instruction for what to do if they run into trouble when using, that laptop. And so I don't imagine we're seeing a lot of new things with respect to high schoolers, because they've been using technology now in a lot of different ways for a variety of different purposes. But if you have somebody who's relatively new to technology or is getting access to more technology than they've ever had and doesn't have the tools to kind of deal with abuse that they might see, that's when you might see some problems.
So your center actually teamed up with the Cartoon Network to put out a study on cyberbullying, and it found that 1 in 5 tweens, so ages 9 to 12, have experienced cyberbullying in some way. Justin, what does cyberbullying look like, so we have a really good sense of what we're dealing with?
Well, cyberbullying can range from a lot of different behaviors, but it usually looks like hurtful comments on social media pages or maybe somebody makes a hurtful social media profile about another person or sends them threats or inappropriate images. In all the ways that kids can be bullied at school, there are definitely ways that those behaviors can manifest themselves using technology as well. Maybe not the physical aspect of it, but certainly the hurtful comments, the rumors, the gossip. And as we know, with technology being everywhere, that bullying can occur 24/7.
We're talking right now about cyberbullying. Justin Patchen is with us, professor of criminal justice at UW-Eau Claire and co-director of the Cyberbullying Research Center. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Has your child ever been cyberbullied? How did that affect them? Have you had concerns about interactions your kids have had online? Is cyberbullying something you've talked with your kids about? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Justin, what are some of the impacts that we see on kids, both in the long and short term, when they've been the object, the target of cyberbullying?
Well, we know that young people who are cyberbullied feel kind of helpless, because oftentimes they don't know how to get it to stop, or they don't know who to tell. It's taken a while. I've been studying these behaviors for almost 20 years, and I think we're at the point now where most of us adults recognize the harm associated with cyberbullying, but it wasn't always that way, because our adult brains basically say, we'll just turn off the technology or block them. But that's much harder for young people to do. So they feel like they don't know what to do to stop it. And as a result, there are some emotional consequences. They're angry, they're sad, they're depressed. But we definitely have seen in our research impacts on kind of school performance and friendships and, you know, family life. And so it really impacts their whole life in a number of different ways.
And it seems that neither you nor I are child psychologists, but it seems that there is an element of this too, that kids feel like if they are the target, the object of the attention of this group, that it's kind of like the whole world is watching and the whole world is taking part of it. And that isolation, it means that they have fewer and fewer outlets to feel healthy and feel valued.
That's right. And what we see is if a young person, let's say a classmate posts something that's hurtful about you online, the perception for the target, at least, is that everybody's in on the joke. Everybody's seen it. Everybody's kind of laughing behind your back. It could be that one or two people saw it or nobody else saw it, but just the perception that everybody's in on it, it makes it like you're constantly looking over your shoulder to see who's laughing at you. And at least when it comes to school bullying, you can go home at the end of the day and you've got some protection in your house. Whereas with the cyberbullying, it can reach all corners of your life and you're just constantly on edge.
And with the fact that so many young people, children, have access not just to a tablet or to a laptop, something like that for school, but also, say, smartphones, some of this takes the shape of, for instance, taking a video of someone when they are in a place that they expect privacy, like, you know, in a locker room or even in their own home.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, you really have to be aware of all the ways that a picture could be taken of you, a video could be taken of you. And even if it's not in an area where privacy is expected, it could just be, you know, some public space, but that image could be manipulated, could be photoshopped, could be altered in a way that makes it look like you're doing other things or in some way makes fun of you. So teens are very creative with the ways that they can use technology to cause harm to their peers. And I see examples of cyberbullying literally every day, and nothing ceases to surprise me anymore about the creativity of the harm that can be caused.
Well, and is that part of it too, Justin, that this generation that we're talking about being both the perpetrators and the targets of cyberbullying are probably, for the most part, a lot more tech savvy than their parents or teachers, and they might be on platforms that we don't even know are out there?
There's no question about it. They're definitely ahead of the curve. And, you know, I live and breathe this stuff, and I can't keep up with the new spaces that they're hanging out on. And so it's likely that if parents have heard of a new app or a new game, that they're already way behind the curve in terms of what's been going on there.
Let's go to the phones. And Chris in Appleton is up at 800-642-1234. Chris, hi.
Hi, and I think you just answered my question. I work with teenagers, and I even ask them, you know, what platforms do they use? And they don't use Facebook or Instagram very much anymore. And do you know of any other names of platforms they may be using? Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
Yeah, Chris. I mean, it really depends on the age of the child, because that varies significantly. Instagram is still fairly popular among older adolescents, but right now it's all about TikTok and Snapchat and just these kind of short ways of interacting with others via video. There's a lot of kind of live streaming apps that are out there today. And we actually have on our website, cyberbullying.org, information about kind of new apps. And so if you're interested, it can take you down a rabbit hole of a lot of apps you never knew existed.
Well, and Snapchat is one where, at least in theory, the messages, the photos, the videos, whatever it is, are supposed to disappear after a certain amount of time. But is that really true?
Well, no, I think we've known for a long time that those images don't disappear. And certainly it's easy to take a screenshot, or, you know, if you have multiple devices, you can take a photo or a video of something that appears, you know, on the Snapchat app. And I think most young people who use Snapchat realize that now. So that doesn't necessarily stop them from posting things they probably shouldn't be posting, but that's a separate issue. But yeah, theoretically, those images disappear, at least they're not visible for a long period of time, but they definitely can be captured.
Justin Patchen is a professor of criminal justice in the Department of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. He's also co-director of the Cyberbullying Research Center. We're looking at whether the shift to so much schooling being online has increased cyberbullying. We're looking at what cyberbullying looks like and what we can do. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Parents, what concerns do you have about cyberbullying? Have you already felt the effects on your child or on other families? How are you handling the issue? Is it something you've talked with your own kids about? Do you feel like you have enough information to have that conversation? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation about cyberbullying and how parents can spot it with Justin Patchen. He's a professor of criminal justice at UW-Eau Claire and the co-director of the Cyberbullying Research Center. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What worries you about how this type of bullying might affect kids as more of their lives are spent online? What questions do you have about how to help prevent or stop cyberbullying? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. And let's go right to the phones. Angela in Waukesha is up. Hi, Angela.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you? What would you like to share?
I'm good. So my question is, I'm an educator, and obviously we deal and we know about cyberbullying that happens with our students, and obviously a lot of it is happening outside of school. And one of the things is, what can we legally as a school do, or is that landscape kind of changing where we would be able to help intervene on behalf of students that are facing cyberbullying? Right now, it seems there's very little we are told that we can do unless the issues comes into the school some way to affect the school environment.
Thanks so much for that call, Angela. What, Justin, would you recommend to Angela and teachers like her who are concerned but feel like they have very limited influence in this?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's a question I've been dealing with in my research since the beginning. And because teachers were really the first to recognize the seriousness of this problem, but yet also recognizing the limitations of kind of the school setting or educators within that setting to deal with it, because Angela's right, a lot of it, most of it is happening outside of the school. But the reality is many of the consequences of that cyberbullying do end up at school. So from a legal standpoint, if there's a connection to the school, if anything that happens outside of school, whether it's bullying, cyberbullying, or anything, if it has a substantial impact of the learning environment at school or impacts the rights of students to feel safe at school or to learn, that's when the school has the right to intervene. That's relatively straightforward, but the next most important question is, by doing what, right? Mm-hmm. And so is there some formal response like a suspension or detention or something like that, or something less formal? And what we usually recommend to schools is talk with the students involved, because usually 85% of the time, if there's cyberbullying happening, there's bullying happening at school. So usually there's something happening at school, and sort of dig deeper to find out what's going on and try to address the behavior like you would in any bullying that happened in school. Ultimately, the goal is to get it to stop, and that might require some formal intervention, but it usually doesn't. So addressing it in that way usually keeps you safe, but it's a lot easier said than done. It's a big challenge for sure.
Well, and I could see parents or teachers worrying that if they intervene in the wrong way, that they could inadvertently make the situation worse by maybe having the bully be angry that they've been called out and kind of doubling up on their efforts. Is there any concern about that, or is it always better to step in if you see it happening?
That's completely true. And we know from our research that young people are reluctant to tell adults about their experience with bullying or cyberbullying. And it's been that way for generations. It's been that way since I was a kid, right? And the reason for that is because kids are afraid if they tell adults about these experiences, the adult is just going to make it worse by many of the reasons you just stated. It's going to get worse for me because I'm going to get picked on more. It's going to become more hidden. And the reason they believe that is because they see that. They see examples of that. And so really it's up to us as adults to respond in a way that doesn't exacerbate the situation, doesn't make it worse. And that does take some time and thought and creativity. And it doesn't necessarily mean dropping the hammer on the kid who is misbehaving, but it does mean doing what is necessary to stop the bullying wherever it's happening. And again, that does take some effort.
Talking with Justin Patchen right now. He is the co-director of the Cyberbullying Research Center. We are talking about how to spot cyberbullying, how to talk to our kids about it, and what to do. You can join in at 800-642-1234. I want to flip this over a little bit, Justin, and I want to talk about what we know about the cyberbullies themselves or bullies themselves. Are there some characteristics of who engages in that type of behavior?
Well, that's a tricky question. There are. I mean, one of the very first academic papers we ever wrote was trying to come up with like a profile of one who would engage in cyberbullying or one who would be a target. And there wasn't any clear factors. The reality is most cyberbullying that occurs is a function of some relationship gone bad. And so we were friends and now we're not. And so now I'm going to say hurtful things about you online and it's going to escalate from there. In some cases, the kids really are emotionally, you know, they've got some issues emotionally or psychologically, and they like to see other people hurt. And that's kind of rare. I mean, what we're more interested in is the wider problem of just kind of these social dynamics that are happening. And so if you can address the nature of that relationship, then there's nothing particularly unique. There used to be this belief that, you know, the people who are doing the bullying are the big, mean, gruff, you know, boys. Well, that's not necessarily the case. And particularly when it comes to cyberbullying, we see examples of socially strong kids engaging in these behaviors and being able to do so kind of under the radar of adults. And so the bottom line is it really could be anyone, and you need to kind of be aware of that.
So you just talked about being under the radar of adults, but are there any signs that parents, teachers, other adults who are around young people may be seeing them online or not? Are there any clues that we might want to pay attention to that we might know someone on the bullying side?
Yeah, I think it's the normal kind of the pieces of advice I think we've received as parents in the 21st century now for a while. Just kind of pay attention to what your kids are doing online. And every once in a while, look over their shoulder and be in the room with them when they're using their devices. And if they're laughing hysterically at something, maybe ask the question, what's so funny? Maybe show that to me. Or because, I mean, you like a good joke, too. And as long as it's not targeting somebody specifically, then it's probably fine. But having those conversations, I think, you know, there obviously are a lot of technological tools that parents can use if they're really concerned about the behavior of their kids in terms of monitoring and tracking and kind of certain software solutions. But ultimately, I think the best course of action is having an open line of communication with your child so that they understand that these behaviors are wrong and the harm associated with being hurtful to others online, and also potentially understanding the trouble they could get into at school or otherwise, but also opening up that line of communication in case your child is the target. And we do know that there are what we call aggressor targets who experience it and then dish it out, right? So the more we can communicate with our kids, the better on this.
And can you give us maybe, you know, a good opening? Because I think for some parents, especially if they don't feel like they're very technologically savvy, they might not even know how to start the conversation. And I'm sure it depends on the age of the child, too. But can you maybe give us, you know, a line or two that parents can use to kind of open the door?
Yeah, this is very tricky. And you're right. It does depend on the age. The one thing I would say is choose the appropriate time to broach this subject. You know, don't start talking about these heavy issues, you know, right after school when they're tired and hungry and not in a good mood anyways, right? So find a time when they're open to these kinds of conversations. Another thing you can do is if you hear about a new app, right? Maybe you've never heard of TikTok. You might be living under a rock, but maybe you've never heard of TikTok. If you don't know much about TikTok, ask your kids, what is this TikTok thing? You know, why do you like it? Or do you even use it? Do you see anybody engaging in a hurtful way on this app? How could somebody do this? Has anybody done this to you? So use the knowledge that you gain from listening to great radio programs like this to dig deeper with your kids on this. And even more specifically, because we know how difficult of a conversation this is, we on our website, cyberbullying.org, we actually have scripts that you can use. If you want it kind of spelled out, you can kind of read some of the scripts that we have, and that can help guide you to have those opening conversations.
And Justin, before we let you go, for people listening right now, for young people who are listening who might be the object of cyberbullying, what would you tell them to help them get through what is, I think we all understand, an extremely difficult situation?
I will say that it will get better. A couple of things you can do. Save all the evidence of cyberbullying. So take a screenshot, save message conversations. Do not retaliate. Don't say mean things back. I know it's really hard not to do that. I mean, I think even as adults, we want to kind of say something back. Keep all the evidence. Learn how to block and report users on all the apps you're using so that you can try to, you know, get rid of those negative people in your life. And if it gets to a point, you can enlist the help of a friend, but if it gets to the point where you can't deal with it, talk to an adult you trust. Maybe it's your parents, maybe it's somebody at school, a coach, a mentor. And if all else fails, look us up online and we'll do what we can to help.
And give us that website again.
Cyberbullying.org.
Justin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Judith.
Justin Patchen is co-director of the Cyberbullying Research Center. We talked with him about how to spot and address cyberbullying as students spend more of their time online. Organizing the polls on Election Day is never easy, but it's looking like an especially big challenge this year amid the COVID-19 pandemic and a contentious presidential campaign. Our next guest looked to the data to find out what the most efficient way to staff and run voting places will be on November 3rd. Using the city of Milwaukee as a model, her work came up with 5 recommendations for Election Day. Laura Albert is a professor of industrial and systems engineering at UW-Madison. Laura, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Where did the idea come from to try to look at the most efficient and effective ways to stage the election?
That's a great question. I study systems and industrial engineering and how to protect critical infrastructure, and elections are critical infrastructure. This summer, I didn't leave the house very frequently, but one time when I did, I ran into Professor Barry Burden at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in the political science department. He's an expert at politics, and we were chatting about the importance of queuing theory and designing elections. And I'm an expert at queuing theory.
And so I'm going to stop you. What's queuing theory?
It's the science of waiting in line.
All right.
So industrial engineers don't like waiting in line. And it becomes very important when designing elections. And he's been involved with the Wisconsin Election Committee's preparations for the fall elections. And industrial engineering tools like queuing theory are pretty relevant. And I was really interested in studying this, especially using Milwaukee as a case study because of their spring primary election was a little controversial. Mm-hmm. And so I developed a detailed discrete event simulation model to study a variety of possible operating conditions on election day. And if we change the inputs a little bit, we can look at the outputs, which is usually voter waiting time, but also things like voter safety. Hmm. And we can get some insight into how to design a safe and efficient election.
Well, let's look at one of the factors, which is the number of poll workers needed to make this run smoothly in this particular case. What did you come up with?
Sure. So that was one of the challenges, was preparing for a safe election when there are potential poll worker shortages. And when we did the simulation, we found that having a high level of staffing, even with a high level of early voting, is really critical. And that was a surprising finding because so many voters plan to vote early and many already have at this point. But what happens is that there are so many protective measures in place, even things like just wearing masks and bringing your own pen and having plexiglass barriers, those things slow down the voting process, in particular the check-in process. And if you just slow that down for a few seconds for each voter, a long line becomes a record-setting long line. And so it's really important for this election to have more poll workers to first have extra check-in stations, since that's the bottleneck, but then also to direct voters and provide some additional information.
And you also looked at safety. Obviously, you had some recommendations for extra safety measures, not just like you talked about, like wiping things down, but going back to that queuing theory and standing in line. What are some of the ideas you had for extra safety?
Sure. So most queues, especially for something like voting, are first come, first serve. Everybody waits in a line, and that's widely seen as fair. And I would generally say that's pretty fair. In terms of safety for voters, it's the first come, first serve means that there's unequal risk for some voters in terms of acquiring the COVID-19 virus. And that's something that a lot of election officials and voters and poll workers are concerned with. And you can't really open up the polls for an extra hour for high-risk voters in the morning because mm-hmm. you need the same voting times for everyone.
Which is what has been done in grocery stores and things like that.
Exactly. It would be great if we could use that idea. So instead, we proposed a priority queue model, which is kind of like with TSA PreCheck. If they have a single person checking IDs and you've got the regular flyers and then the TSA PreCheck flyers, and then you can kind of alternate voters, you know, take one from the priority line and one from the regular line. And this way, the voters who self-identify is high risk for the just the risks associated with the COVID-19 virus can wait less in line. And the question is, well, does this make the wait unfair for everybody else? And it does increase the wait for everybody else, but no more than about 15%. And that might be a good balance. It's up to election officials to decide whether or not to implement it. But from our end, it's in terms of the numbers, it seems feasible.
Talking with Laura Albert right now. She's a professor of industrial and systems engineering at UW-Madison, talking about looking at the data to make Election Day run more smoothly and more safely. And Laura, one more point that I found really interesting is the idea of using arenas. And in Milwaukee, the Fiserv Forum in Miller Park will be used for in-person absentee voting between October 20th and November 1st, not sites on Election Day, but that early voting. What did you find out about the logistics of voting in sports arenas like that?
I'm enthusiastic about using sports arenas before Election Day as a site to encourage early voting. That's one thing suggestion that came out of my analysis is that early voting is really important. At least half of all votes should be cast early, and ideally about three quarters. So having these sports arenas that can encourage that is great. They've also been proposed to be used for in-person voting on Election Day, and I'm less enthusiastic about that suggestion. If that happens, that means voters could either vote at their local polling place or they could choose to go to one of these sports arenas. And some cities, voters have a choice. Mm-hmm. What is counterintuitive about that, you know, there seems like there's a couple upsides. One is that they're extra voting resources, and the large arenas are good for social distancing. They're enormous. So in terms of safety, that makes sense. But the downside is that they don't really put the voting resources where they're needed. Hmm. And so what happens is just if you take the city of Milwaukee, for example, with its 182 polling stations. The city of Los Angeles, or the county of Los Angeles, has nearly 1,000 polling locations. And if you just take a couple percent of those voters from all of those different polling locations and you filter them into the same arena that can overwhelm the sports arena, there's only so many check-in booths that they can staff. And then some of those polling locations where they really do have long waits, now those voters have two choices and they're both bad. There's a line at their local polling location, and now there's a line at the arena. So it would be better if we can just have extra staffing at the polling locations where they're needed the most. In the city of Milwaukee, for example, the average voter travels about half a mile to vote, which is great. You don't need a car. You can just walk there. And so if those voters don't have to wait, then they're more likely to vote.
And very briefly, Laura, before we let you go, your analysis used Milwaukee as a model, but could this be applied to the rest of the state as well?
Oh, most definitely. Voting's pretty much the same throughout the state, and in fact, across the country in states that have in-person voting. The details vary, but the whole process is uniform, and so the ideas definitely generalize. And in every state, they use some queuing theory to estimate the number of check-in booths, voting booths, and poll workers that they may need. So queuing theory is playing a role, and the same models can work for multiple states and cities.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
Laura Albert is a professor of industrial and systems engineering at UW-Madison. She talked with us about her recommendations for logistics this election day. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. The Evers administration planned to release the names of more than 1,000 Wisconsin businesses last Friday that had at least two employees who have tested positive for COVID-19. However, a lawsuit filed by Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce has prevented that from happening for the time being. Ryan Walsh is a lawyer at Eimer Stahl, LLP. He's representing the WMC in a lawsuit to stop release of businesses connected to COVID-19 cases. Ryan, thanks so much for joining us.
And thanks for having me, Judith.
So, Ryan, prior to the lawsuit being filed, what was the state's approach to handling cases where employees of a business had tested positive?
Judith, they hadn't done anything, really. This goes back 3 or 4 months. There's been a back and forth with the administration about what it ought to do with the names of the businesses that it's compiled. At first, the governor said he was going to put together a dashboard where interested viewers could jump on a website and look at a list of places with quote-unquote outbreaks. He got significant pushback on that idea and backed off it and then said, well, at least I'll have to respond to public records requests. At that point, WMC responded with a letter saying even that would be unlawful because it would expose private confidential health records to the public. And the governor relented and appeared to relent anyway. In a September press conference, he said, we agree there are privacy concerns here. We're not going to do it. And then to our surprise, just the other day, we learned with less than 12 hours notice that he had once again planned on releasing the names. And that's when we sprung into action.
So I want to clarify a point there because you talked about the privacy issue, but what they were talking about doing was releasing the names of the businesses, not the names of the specific employees, correct?
Right. The problem is for the administration that under state health care privacy law, even a patient's employer is a confidential public health record. And the administration seems to recognize that because they've said, at the very least, they're not going to release the names of employers with 25 employees or fewer. Hmm. And that recognizes that at least they understand that even at a given point, if the employer is small enough, there's a risk of disclosure. But our argument is there's the same risk even with employers who have over 25 workers. You know, 25 isn't a magic number. You could easily imagine, you know, a Costco or a Home Depot put on the list and the coworkers start searching around and talking to each other and they figure out that, well, so-and-so was out in July. Maybe so-and-so had COVID-19. And the rumor starts, and it doesn't take long for the rumor to get to the front page of the newspaper that an outbreak at a Home Depot was caused by so-and-so. The problem is that the planned release of names covers businesses that have been connected to COVID-19 going back all the way to May. This is going to cause mass confusion. People are going to think that these employers are somehow risky, that they ought to be avoided, that they have outbreaks or they're hotspots. Nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, it could be that a restaurant makes the list because it had two servers catch the virus in July while at a beach. And those servers might not have ever come into work. They could have self-isolated. They could have self-quarantined for 14 days and then returned to work when it was safe to do so. We're arguing that for that restaurant to be put on the list is fundamentally unfair and not lawful.
We asked our listeners on Facebook whether or not the public should be told when and where businesses have confirmed COVID cases. Ezra on Facebook wrote that he doesn't believe the government should force businesses to tell. That should be a decision left to the business. I'm wondering what the WMC position is if a business wants to take that step and say, hey, we want to let our customers know that we had, you know, a couple of employees with COVID-19, fill in the date. Is that something that you would support?
Well, we fully agree that's a different issue, and that would be for the employer to assess with the employee whether that could be done lawfully. I mean, I as an individual have every right to make public my health records if I want to. So that would be between the employee and the employer. The problem here is that although we all appreciate the ability to be able to view public records, you know, WMC itself requests public records and favors government transparency. The rules apply a little differently when the government has come to obtain healthcare records. Taxpayers fund VA hospitals, but no one would argue that because taxpayers pay for those facilities, we have the right to know who was diagnosed with what at such a hospital. So there's an interplay here, and that interplay has to be considered and approached very carefully.
And briefly, we don't have a lot of time. Pam on Facebook writes, I would like to know, and the business can reassure me that they're taking precautions once COVID is detected. I have so much respect for the businesses that have a case shut down to do a thorough cleaning and follow up with employees. What would you say to someone like Pam?
Well, I'd say, Pam, WMC is urging its members and equipping its members with information to operate as safely as possible under the guidelines. And we, the consumers, the patrons of these businesses, should not assume that any particular business is riskier than another. We should take proper precautions wherever we go and not take comfort based on a list that's compiled on the basis of information that's many, many months old.
Well, Ryan, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll certainly be following this story as it develops.
Thank you, Judith.
Ryan Walsh is a lawyer at Eimer Stahl LLP. He's representing Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce in a lawsuit to stop release of the names of businesses connected to COVID-19 cases. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show. Tomorrow after 7, since the pandemic began, millions of Americans have lost their jobs and many are struggling to pay for necessities. A national reporter joins Kate Archer Kent to explain how COVID-19 has created the current economic crisis and what the next steps are. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll discuss the documentary The Social Dilemma. A social media and marketing professor puts it into perspective for us. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson in for Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.